Hey, y'all, it's Chip Patterson from the Cover 3 Podcast, part of the CBS Sports Podcast Network. College football is about to enter its first ever 12-team playoff era, so join me, along with Tom Fornelli, Danny Cannell, and Bud Elliott, as we drop new episodes 5 times a week to close out the year. We've got reactions, bracket breakdowns, and best bets for these matchups with championship stakes. Follow and listen to the Cover 3 Podcast on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's the Chris and Amy show on KMOX. No Amy today. She is out. She'll be back on Monday, or she better. I swear she better be. That's Nate Gatter sitting in with me, Chris Ranji. Glad you're with us today. And we go to the Quiver River Electric guest line, and we visit with Scott McFarland, CBS News congressional correspondent, who is with us this morning. How's it going, Scott?
Hey, Merry Christmas. Good to be with you both.
Hey, first of all, let me just tell you, no, eggnog is not overrated. It's fantastic. I saw your tweet, it is occurring to me now. I've had none of it all season, so that's not good.
Does that maybe fly in the face of what you're saying? Maybe you subconsciously do think it's overrated?
No, I think it's wonderful.
There it is.
I love it so much.
I don't know.
Also, Scott, I saw that you received... I just watched the Muppets Christmas Carol a couple of nights ago, and you received animal socks.
Nice choice by the kids who ordered them for me far enough in advance, because, you know, at the Muppet clothes making specialist, it's a bit of a backlog at the holiday season. So I'm glad they went in early, got those animal socks and the Statler and Waldorf sweater. They got those done ahead of time.
Oh, I didn't know you got that, too. That's unbelievable. Well, Merry Christmas to you, Scott. And there's nothing like being back at work the day after Christmas. And as we're covering the president-elect Trump transition, he's going to become president in January. This Panama Canal thing, which over the last week or so is new, it really feels to have come out of nowhere. Do we know what the origin of his recent interest in that is?
I say this only somewhat cynically, and somewhat as a wise guy, but perhaps there was a Fox News or talk radio segment that reintroduced the concept of the controversy that was there in the late 70s that our parents, some of us remember, when it was given back to Panama. I mean, that was a controversial move 2 to 3 generations ago that may have just spurred the interest in Donald Trump. I mean, there are fees America pays to use the Panama Canal. There are costs to using the canal. It certainly is the economic driver of Panama itself, but Panama is under the unequivocal notion that that is theirs, and there's no, I guess, pressure or momentum in Congress or at the state level for the U.S. to interfere with that.
Do you think there will build momentum for that? Because sometimes it seems like ideas, when they come from him, have no... It's like they're coming from nowhere. And then suddenly they do have momentum because there are a lot of people who want to carry out his agenda. So do you think momentum does build in that direction from Congress?
I think everything he said runs counter to there being momentum on this. I mean, he has campaigned successfully on decreasing foreign entanglements and going, you know, into other nations and interfering with their business or putting U.S. forces elsewhere in the world. So it's contradictory to other things he says. It's also such a far-fetched notion. I don't see a wall of support building behind this. Perhaps best he's doing this over the holidays.
Scott, for those of us who don't recall the controversies of yesteryear, can you explain maybe some of the levers at play here and kind of who would stand to really benefit such that they might be part of why President-elect Trump all of a sudden is showing interest in this kind of out of nowhere?
Yeah, the history of this, which of course begins with the development of the Panama Canal and the loss of lives by the thousands doing that remarkably Herculean task, peaked in controversy in the late 70s when President Carter decided to return the Panama Canal to the people of Panama and to, I guess, divest the U.S. government of its equity and interests in the Panama Canal. I think what Donald Trump is picking up on there was the frustration that surrounded that decision when he was younger, a few generations ago, when it seemed like the U.S. was losing its might, its force across the globe, and it was surrendering something. That's symmetrical to Donald Trump's promises that the U.S. needs to show its might, to show its toughness, to increase its equity in other parts of the world. But again, it runs counter to him saying we shouldn't get entangled with other potential unrest in other parts of the world. So I don't know where that heads next, but it does hit a sweet spot with a certain part of his constituency, which remembers the frustration and the anger of the late 70s when that decision was made.
CBS News congressional correspondent Scott McFarlane is with us here on KMOX. And as we are preparing for another Trump presidency here, just generally speaking, what has this transition been like compared to what it was the first time he assumed office?
A couple differences. I mean, first of all, the efficiency with which these nominations have been made is noteworthy and certainly different. I mean, with such rapid pacing, he has named all these would-be contenders for his cabinet. It's almost been fluid, which is different than 2016 when there was more herky-jerky and things happened a little more in the 11th hour. But he's certainly gone further down some very dark passages for some of these nominees. I mean, there are going to be controversial hearings for at least a good chunk of these nominees. He has put some polarizing, provocative figures forward, more so than he did 8 years ago when there were some more mainstream government-experienced candidates. I mean, just think about Pete Hegseth's going to have a bumpy confirmation hearing. The Democrats have kept their powder dry, but there are all number of it. There's a whole number of allegations they can pick up on. RFK Jr., so far, the Democrats have kept their powder dry. But any number of vaccine stances he's taken that will cause noise in the confirmation hearings. Tulsi Gabbard has been accused of being a Putin puppet, somebody who echoes Russian talking points. And oh, by the way, there's still Kash Patel, who to call polarizing is an understatement. Democrats have not targeted these nominees yet with what they're going to bring at confirmation hearings. And there's already been bumps on the road. That's different than 8 years ago.
Scott, bearing in mind the polarization of some of those, the polarity of some of those nominees that he has put forward already, and that there are remain significant fights for confirmation, even with Matt Gaetz having withdrawn his name. Do you think that President Trump and his transition team maybe regret the Gaetz nomination and the attention that that drew as just sort of further underscoring that maybe he had gone a little extreme on these nominees relative to what he was doing 8 years ago?
It certainly caused a bump or two they didn't need to have in the initial days of this transition. I don't know if they would say they regret it, but it certainly didn't win them anything. But there is the argument, a pretty compelling argument, that by putting forward a number of controversial picks at the same time necessarily dilutes the attention and scrutiny each one gets. There's safety in numbers for the Trump transition team by putting so many different targets up at the same time. There are only so many times people can open political fire at any one of them, and that may work to their benefit. And Matt Gaetz further diluted the attention that would otherwise have been given to Tulsi Gabbard and to Pete Hegseth and to RFK Jr.
I imagine that the support for Matt Gaetz on the Hill is not as great as, and I'm speaking from the perspective of Republicans even. That's just my guess. Observing from the outside, I would think there probably aren't a whole lot of Republicans who actually like him very much. Is that the case, or does he have more support than we think?
I think that's Matt Gaetz's biggest problem, is that he has any number of acrimonious relationships with fellow Republicans. I mean, at least two Republicans on the House Ethics Committee voted to release that damning Ethics Committee investigation of Gaetz on Monday. And that tells you about the fractured relationships that are there, because that was a bold step. The House Ethics Committee tends not to release reports of members who are no longer in their jurisdiction or in the U.S. Congress. Matt Gaetz ousted a House Speaker for the first time in American history in late 2023 by leading the charge to get rid of Kevin McCarthy. That fractured relationships. He is, to put it mildly, a high-profile figure and kind of devoured the attention that would otherwise go to some of his colleagues with so many high-profile moves and so many high-drama moments. I'm not sure he has a stable foundation of Republican support in this Congress, and that may be another reason why he decided to exit.
Scott McFarlane, CBS News, with us on KMOX, and you have been covering for, you know, several years now, all of the January 6th, the various trials that have taken place, and we are 10 days away from, you know, the next January 6th. So with a new administration coming in, and one that has a pretty vested interest in what happens with a lot of these defendants, how do you assume, or how do you think a lot of these, you know, these outcomes will go? Will they be overturned? Will he end up trying to, you know, pardon all or many of them? What do you think happens next there?
Well, he has unambiguously pledged pardons for at least some of the January 6th defendants, but you've really hit on a point of frustration for me, because he's never been pressed to clarify what that means. Is it going to be everybody? Is it going to be all 1,600 riot defendants? Or is it going to be just some, a subgroup, those who were not violent, those who were not convicted of felonies? He's never clarified. Will he allow the Department of Justice to continue with new January 6 cases? There are still hundreds of people being sought, including the alleged pipe bomber. Would he allow the Department of Justice to continue investigating, or is he going to shut that down? Will he commute or pardon? Big difference in changing somebody's sentence versus wiping their slate clean. He's never clarified. When people have tried to prod him and poke him on that, he's been unclear with his responses. We don't know where this is going. But I know what our Department of Justice sources tell us is that they're concerned with the message this sends. A broad set of pardons or commutations sends a message that political violence is acceptable if your guy eventually takes power. That is third world stuff, and that is a message that will be communicated through pardons, no matter your political persuasion.
The Department of Justice and anybody who works in it will vehemently deny that the department has been weaponized in any way, that they operate independently. The current president has said that he doesn't interfere with what they do, what decisions it is that they make. Is there, how much fear is there that that could change? First of all, if it's even true, because a lot of people believe that that department has been weaponized. I personally do not believe that to be the case. But this incoming administration has been pushing that idea that it has. So what is that community saying about what is to come next?
What a Rorschach test that question is. Is the Department of Justice weaponized? The Trump team and Trump supporters would argue not only has it been weaponized because he was charged with novel criminal cases, but that because he campaigned on it being weaponized and a majority of Americans backed him, that there's almost a mandate to consider the Department of Justice weaponized. The Trump opponents would argue, what type of weaponized Department of Justice under Democratic rule would indict the president's son, the Democratic senator from New Jersey, and the Democratic congressman from Southern Texas? So you can make it an ink blot test and read it how you want to, but they're certainly concerned that the Trump team feels they're emboldened to do a tit for tat here and to respond in kind to what they view to be the weaponization of the Department of Justice. They may feel inclined to go ahead and do something similar.
You know, speaking of the current administration, I know we talked about this last week on the show, the pardons that President Biden had issued, and the one of his son in particular, which is a very big deal after saying he would not do it. It seems like, Scott, that did not go over well in Congress, and that includes members of the Democratic Party. Is that true?
Yep. I think that's fair. I think that's very fair. Partly because he said so unequivocally that he wouldn't do it. So there's at least a concern of hypocrisy marring his legacy. But also, it didn't go through the traditional processes. It didn't go through the very elaborate process that pardon requests must go through or typically go through. It was unilateral, and it was a process cut short. There's definitely a concern that that emboldens Donald Trump to do more of the same and issue broad-based pardons unilaterally without them going through the system that is supposed to ensure the pardons are righteous.
What about the clemency issued to the 37 federal death row inmates?
That's firing up talk radio this week. I mean, you all see that. You all hear that. Up and down the dial, that's become a cable news and a talk radio wedge issue for the holiday week. I think what Trump's arguing is that, you know, this sends the message that is antithetical to law and order by showing any leniency for the worst of the worst of federal criminal defendants. I think what some maybe more politically neutral critics would say is, why 37 of 40, not all 40? If you're making a value judgment, how do you cut off certain people and include others? That's a problem. But this is a statement about the death penalty that I think President Biden would like the world to hear, that the U.S. Is less tolerant of the death penalty. The value of that message, I leave in the eye of the beholder, but it's a message he's very clearly trying to send.
Yeah, I do imagine that granting clemency to the Boston Marathon bomber would not have gone over well with anybody, probably, yeah. Scott McFarlane, CBS News, thank you for checking in with us the day after Christmas. Enjoy your socks and whatever's left of the eggnog.
Same to you guys. Thank you so much.
Scott McFarlane, congressional correspondent for CBS News. He is fantastic. Love having him on the show. I've got Nate Gatter with me, Chris Ranji. And yes, by the way, in talking about those 37 commuting, these sentences that were commuted to 37 people, the three who were not were Dzhokhar Tsarnaev, the Boston Marathon bomber, Dylan Roof, who did the shooting in the black church in South Carolina, and then Robert Bowers, who was the Tree of Life synagogue shooter. So those are the three people that he did not offer those to. Everybody else, though, he did. Nate Gatter, Chris Ranji, leave us a voice message or a text. You can leave us a text, 314-436-7900. Voice messages on the Audacy app, AUDACY.